So you got Muna's one just now, huh?
Yeah.
You're not going to overwrite it, I hope.
No.
Okay.
This is the second folder.
Okay. Just in case, yes.
Just safe.
Yes.
Okay. So maybe yes. You can start with
introduction. Okay. My name is Alfian Saad. I'm the resident playwright of Wild Rice Theatre Company. But I also write plays for Theatre Kabatra.
Okay. Yeah. So let's start with maybe like you talking a little bit about KKBL and the process maybe.
Yeah, okay. Kakak Kau Punya Lelaki was a play that I proposed to Eka Matra, I think sometime last year. Yeah, maybe in the beginning of last year. So Zizi actually invited me to work with the company. She was still in town at that point of time, yeah. And they were going to do, you know, it was part of Eka Matra's 25th anniversary celebrations. And I think one of the things they wanted to do was to call back some of their collaborators and do something with the company. And so I don't know how I got the idea, but I think it has a lot to do with the title. I've always wanted to do a play whose title is sort of borrowed from contemporary Singapore slang, Malay slang. And in Malay, there's this very cheeky phrase, which is Kakak Kau Punya Lelaki, which literally is translated as the sister of your... Kakak Kau Punya Lelaki. No, your husband's sister. Yeah, this is the sister of your husband. The sister of your husband, kakak. No, the husband of your sister. I'm sorry. The husband of your sister. Yeah, I'm sorry. It's so hard to translate between English and Malay. So the husband of your kakak, like, yes, the husband of your sister or your sister's husband. It's quite a cheeky phrase because it's supposed to be a sort of euphemism or way of actually saying mak kau punya. Yes. Because should I say it? Mak kau punya P-U-K-I. And P-U-K-I actually is the female genitalia. Yeah. Okay? So it means, you know, and a lot of swearing in whatever language always involves female genitalia, and it's very rude also to invoke one's mother in it. So mak becomes kakak, and then P-U-K-I or P-U-K-I becomes lucky, right? And then, so actually, that's a slang for it, lah. Mm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what was some of the inspiration behind the production, or the stimulus behind the production?
Yeah. So, you know, it was just a wild idea. It was like, okay, what kind of slang shall we, and you know, I always found myself a bit tickled when people use this particular phrase, you know, they would just scold each other and then say, oh, kakak kami laki lah, you know, and it sounds very innocuous, literally, but of course the subtext is supposed to be a swear word. So I think I wanted to do a play where there was always this subtext or something that was dangerous, that was menacing, there was also obscene, you know, underneath the surface. So that was that. And then I think along the way, I also wanted to write a play about terrorism and detention without trial, and basically find a way of speaking about specifically the JI arrests, yeah. I believe in 2002, 1 year after the September 11 attack. So that was a very sensitive moment, I think, for the state and the Malay community. You know, so I don't think people have been able to look back and really address that moment in time. Yeah, because it you know, there was, on one hand, potentially Islamophobia, but on the other hand, also. Also, you know, the state had managed to construct what seemed to be kind of internal security threat. Yeah.
Mm. Okay. And was there, and I think you started talking about it already, but maybe you can continue to elaborate on it.
Yeah.
Was there any theme or central idea that held this concept together in the creation process?
Yeah, was there? So for me, as I mentioned, it was like, how do we talk about this social trauma, you know, this traumatic incident, in a way where we don't have to be defensive, we don't have to be, let's say, apologetic for supposedly grooming or breeding these sociopathic characters like supposedly Maslamat and his gang. Because I think at that point of time it was the Malay community was on the defensive, and all you could do was sort of issue statements saying that, you know, Islam is a religion of peace and we don't condone violence against, you know, people. But because of that, I thought, you know, the community was cornered. We couldn't actually also try to question the mechanics of the act, of the Internal Security Act, you know, the actual elements of justice or injustice, you know, in the use of that act. I mean, obviously, with something like Internal Security Act, you are circumventing usual process of justice, like due process, right? Where is the evidence that these people were going to, you know, bomb? You know, there was this information that was released in the media, etc., that there was intention to bomb Changi Airport, for example, that there was some reconnaissance activities that they were conducting basically to commit terrorist acts. But a lot of this was gathered through intelligence gathering. You know, we didn't have the evidence presented in your usual court of law. There was no trial for the suspects to actually defend themselves. So these people were never convicted. There was no conviction. So this is a problem in the Internal Security Act. No conviction, no sentencing, but then you decide to just detain them for 2 years. And every 2 years, you decide to keep on extending another 2 years. You know, so it can become a very indefinite detention without trial. It is, has been pointed out by many commentators, a certain perversion of justice, lah, you know. Yeah. So I want to talk about that, but not in a way which would be very didactic or polemical. So, well, what was the way to do this? To talk about such a weighty subject, and I thought, okay, it has to be done through farce, you know. And I did write in the program notes, farce would sort of illuminate the absurdities of the Internal Security Act, actually, because its very nature is one where you are highlighting absurdities, where you are really examining, you know, the ironies and the contradictions, yeah, in something like that.
Maybe could you also make the link between the title of this and then the topic behind it?
Ah, yes, right. So, because I had this particular title, right? So it was strange. I mean, I wanted to do something about terrorism, and then it's title. And then I was... and so the question was, who's the sister and who's the husband? We have to figure that out as the characters, right? So I didn't want it to just be a play where people are just saying kakak kami lelaki to each other. So these had to become particular characters. So I was thinking, okay, so let's say there's a character who's based on Maslamat, but she's a woman, and she's actually the kakak, you know, of a couple of sisters. Originally, it was supposed to be three sisters. Huh? So the elder sister. And then, let's say, there's also this husband. So her lucky is her husband. So who's this person? So I eventually settled on this story where you have an elder sister who's a bit strange. Yeah. It's very, very different from the rest of these sisters. And let's say she's a stand-in for any of the GI detainees and specifically Maslamat in particular. And then the rest of the sisters would somehow become symbolic of the Malay community that had to somehow dissociate themselves from this member of their family, you know. And in their attempts to, let's say, help her or rehabilitate her, you know, what are the kinds of violence that they inadvertently commit? Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
And then, what do you feel is unique about this project in regard to your role in it?
What was unique for this project? I mean, I would usually propose a play to Yamatra, and then there'll be a lot of back and forth between me and the directors, and then we'll talk about casting. It's strange because when I did a play Nadira back with the company, I think 2008 or 2009, I had an image of Neo Sui Lin wearing a tudung, and the story developed from there, and she became this character of a Chinese woman who converted to Islam. For KKPL, I had an image of Najib wearing a tudung. So I don't know, maybe subconsciously, you know, my mother is just exerting some kind of influence over me, like, and you know, every day I see my mother, she's wearing tudung, and then I superimpose all these actors' faces on her face, and then suddenly build a whole play, right? I don't know. So maybe the next time, maybe, you know, Ivan Heng in a tudung or something, and then there'll be a play. It's interesting, it could be a tudung trilogy, I haven't thought of that yet. So I wanted to have Najib in a tudung because Najib is so macho. I don't think Najib has played that kind of a role before, you know? And I think what was interesting was that Farid did not want him to played as a drag character. She just happened to be a very masculine woman, right? Which I think accentuated her difference and her austerity from the rest of her sisters, lah.
And what were some of the main artistic or theoretical influences that you had? And I think you started talking about your mom in tudung.
So I think definitely that was it. I wanted to write really something which was fast, lah, you know, which was ridiculous. I wouldn't be able to, because in terms of influences, I think we are influenced by so many things. Some of them Asian, some of them Western, you know, so it's hard to pinpoint those things. But I would say I used to read these Malaysian, very trashy magazines. They're almost like tabloid. And always inside, there are all these supernatural kind of stories, you know? Supernatural stories. There'll be stuff like a missing child abducted by spirits, you know? Yeah, missing for 1 year, but then one day the child comes back and she says, "Oh, I've been gone 1 week." You know, the kind of like spiritual, alternate spiritual plane where time is not the same as in the human world. And then like Pontianak sighted in a Johor Kampong. And yeah, so a lot of these supernatural stories, actually, a lot of them. And I always find it really fascinating that within the Malay community, sure, you know, you have Islam on one side, you know, and it's supposed to be a rational kind of Islam. But there's also that other sort of maybe pre-Islamic, animistic, you know, strain in Malay culture, which believes in bomos and pontianaks and toyos and all these things. And I wanted to put that in the play because this is one of those things that I can do in Malay theatre. You know, and people always ask, "Oh, is, you know, you're bilingual when it comes to theatre, you write in two languages, what makes you want to choose to write in Malay or in English?" And I think for me, writing in Malay allows me to tap into certain cultural consciousness, and fear is a very primal kind of, you know, visceral sort of a shared emotion that I think I have or I share with the Malay community. I mean, sometimes just to say the word Pontianak on stage is, right, for some people, and especially Malay audiences, definitely that's a goosebump moment there. So, yeah, I wanted to have a character who's very, very superstitious and who's probably like, she doesn't read anything else, she just reads all these magazines, and that is her reality.
Right. Mm. Okay. And then, did you have any target audience in mind? And were you consciously communicating anything to them?
Mm.
And how would you gauge your success in this?
Right. I would say that I didn't really have a target audience, you know. I wanted people to come and, number one, be entertained, because it is a farce, it's a comedy. I hoped also that they would be able to see the kinds of analogies and parallels that I was employing in the play. Because the whole idea was that this character was Maslinda Selamat inside my play, right? She's based on Maslamat. But the sisters are all trying to convince her that she has been hypnotized, that she's under a certain spell. Yeah? And I think that's similarly something that the religious rehabilitation group that's sent in to counsel this GI detainees. I think there's also that attempt to say, oh, you have been misled by certain extremists or fundamentalist ideologies, you know, that to believe in these things are wrong. So I felt that was an interesting kind of parallel. You know, what does it mean to deprogram someone? What does it mean to tell someone, oh, you can't think this way, you can't believe, you know, in these things? And is it okay to believe in those things? And is the dividing line acting, to act on those things? You know, so maybe these people really do feel that society or the modern world is just so corrupt, you know, and so decadent, and requires a major kind of reform, like, you know? And do they really believe that the West is intrinsically evil, that the only way to respond to the West is by, you know, is through acts of violence. But then I suppose the tricky thing is, then do you act on that violence? Because, you know, all these grievances about, let's say, Palestine, for example, grievances about symbols of, let's say, Western economic superiority, yeah? The whole idea that they basically control the world economy and everything that is not West is seen as inferior or, you know, ends up being colonized and humiliated and subjugated. So, you know, can you tell these people that no, you shouldn't think this way, because there is an element of truth about the asymmetries of political power in the world right now, right? We are always talking about the global north, which is the European countries, and the developing or underdeveloped south. Yeah, there's still that going on. Yeah, what was the question?
Like, do you feel,
audience, right?
Yeah. But like, because I was talking to Muna, and yep. She was saying that she believes that the Malay audience would have probably gotten something different from the non-Malay audience. So maybe you can go into that as well, because
that
would have been interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, not to make such a fine point out of it, because obviously we have shared experiences as Singaporeans, yeah? But I also do think that, as I mentioned just now, because certain things are still quite culturally embedded. So superstitions, for example, beliefs in all these hantus or whatever, you know, and obviously as a Chinese person, maybe your belief in the supernatural would be something more Hungry Ghost Festival or, you know, Taoist folk beliefs, etc. But then the Malays would have a different pantheon of spirits and ghosts, lah. So obviously there will be those kinds of differences. So I had no expectations of who might come, but it was very interesting to me to see that we had a predominantly Malay audience, you know, which I think was interesting only because Eka Matra has been doing a lot of plays that were sort of a mix within English and Malay, and then we would get maybe quite a mix lah. In terms of the composition audience, maybe 60% Malay audience and then 40%, you know, normally audience, which is healthy also. But I also thought, this is very interesting because on some nights I would say 80 to 90%, you know, Malay members in the audience. And I wondered, is it because the publicity, the marketing itself, the name was sort of very familiar to Malay audiences that they felt, wow, it's our slang. And then as Malay people, we also know that it's you know, the non-literal meaning behind the title. So that's one possibility. The other possibility is you have the actresses' images on the poster and they're all wearing a hijab, for example, you know. And I think maybe some Malay audiences felt, there's a certain sort of validation in this, that they recognize themselves in, you know, in the poster. A lot of them are hijab wearing women also. So suddenly the idea of a play or art doesn't seem so remote anymore. You know, as long as you're able to identify people who you thought represented who you were. It's very different from, say, a play where, and sometimes a lot of these Malay plays are a bit old fashioned, you know, so the poster will have like someone whose face is painted half black, half white, that kind, or someone, you know, in the abstract, and then someone whose face is painted all white, then like got numbers as if it's a clock, you know. So there's this like absurdist, surrealist strains in Malay theatre. I can imagine like the lay person kind of audience looking at that like, what is this? Yeah. So I think because the title was kind of slang, and then you see all this and they are all like in very contemporary hijab fashion, you know, people, it looks like a cover of a Manja magazine, kan?
Right? So whatever influenced you now came out on poster.
Yeah, you know, so a lot of pop culture stuff and all that lah. Yeah.
Okay. Was there any audience or critical feedback that you would like to respond to?
Critical feedback, yeah? There were, I think, a couple of letters to Rita Harian lah. Yeah. One of them talked about the play itself. The other one talked about a photograph that was circulating on the internet. Did you hear about this? It would have addressed this. Oh gosh.
She said she didn't know about any of the feedback.
She didn't know, was it? Okay lah. Maybe she didn't, or she forgot. She blissfully forgot. Yeah. Which is a good thing also. No need to get hung up about this. Okay. Okay. Let's see. One was but maybe I address that image later on lah. But basically, there were two letters. One was to the Straits Times Live, and the other one was a letter to Rita Harian. The one to the Straits Times Live basically said something like, so the writer read up about a preview article in Straits Times where I said the play is sort of based on Maslamat. And then so he wrote a letter to Live and I said, Maslamat is nothing like the character that I'm describing, you know, in that preview article. As in, he said, I need to look for the article, and I'm paraphrasing here, but I do remember that one thing he said is, you know, you shouldn't take artistic license too far, and is making this comparison between Mahathir Mohamad, who is a dangerous terrorist, and this Malay spinster woman who's eccentric. Is it mischievous art? I think he used that particular phrase. You know, is it mischievous art? So basically, I think that writer was making this assertion that I was being irreverent, I was being irresponsible in my role as an artist. I was sort of like making light of the dangers that Mahathir Mohamad ostensibly was posing to Singapore society. So I found that an interesting letter. And there was a similar letter also that was sent into Britta Harian, but with the difference being that the Britta Harian letter, apparently the writer had watched the play, you know? Yeah. And his concern was also similar, that I shouldn't make light of the dangers that, you know, Maslamat was posing. And my response to these two people is very simple. How do they know with absolute certainty that Maslamat was this terrorist? You know, because you define a terrorist as someone who has committed a terrorist act, right? In the absence of that, then who is this person? Suspected terrorist, a proto-terrorist, a pre-terrorist, what, right? Okay, so that's my response to both of them, because I think they take it at very at face value that the Ministry of Home Affairs tells the population, okay, this man is dangerous, and then, oh, he is dangerous. But the Internal Security Act has been used in the past on a lot of people who I myself believe were innocent. Yeah, people who were accused of being Chinese chauvinists, of being communists, you know. But there was no trial, there was no evidence presented. You know, we had to take the Ministry of Home Affairs at their word. If they say this person is guilty, then, oh, guilty. You know, so I felt that something wasn't right lah in sort of completely trusting government agencies that way. You know, I think we still need to be convinced with proof. And actually, so the Ministry of Home Affairs says certain things, but then there are also certain things like, oh, Mahathir Mohamad, the JI in Singapore, Jamaat Islamiyah, wasn't, there was really no evidence they found that they wanted to bomb places in Singapore. It was more about raising funds for a regional JI network, you know, so that was something that sort of put in the play as well, in which the Maslinda character wanted money, you know, to send to her this boyfriend of hers, right? And who was Indonesian, right? Yeah, who was Javanese. So that was also a reference to the links between Singapore JI and the Indonesian one. Yeah, and the Indonesian one was the one that where there was proof that there was involvement in the Bali bombings, for example, you know. But with the Singapore one, there, it's still very, very obscure. Yeah. And you wonder why they can't just go to court, you know? Yeah.
How about the photo that you were talking about?
Ah, yeah, this is a very long story.
Never mind. More the better.
Okay. Now, so this was after the play had finish its run, okay? So one day, on the Ekamatra website, they would put up rehearsal photographs, okay, once in a while. And one of the rehearsal photographs was Muna's birthday. So we had all the cast members gather around her, and then, you know, posing in the camera, there was a cake and there was a candle. Now, this was a break during rehearsals, and they were wearing this thing that was like a hood that covered the ears and the head, and then a bit of the neck, and just exposed the face. to my understanding, this kind of it was something that looked like a scuba diving hood, yeah. And there are photos where they also had a pair of goggles on. In the early stages of rehearsal, the director, right, Farid Jainal, wanted to do a synchronized swimming scene. Yeah, and then they had this on. So anyway, they had this on, and because this was in rehearsal, some of them, like Muna, was wearing sleeveless. Yeah, and then Nolina, another actress, she was wearing either a sleeveless or a t-shirt, but she had shorts on. Yeah, so there was this picture. So someone saw this photo on the Eka Matras site and then started sharing the photo, but then captioned it as, "While our Muslim sisters are trying to get the hijab recognized in by the government or something like that, you know, some other Muslims are making fun of it." Yeah. And then it just got shared and shared and shared with that particular caption. So the original one in the Inka Madras site was just "Happy Birthday, Muna." But this person mischievously captioned it as if we were making fun of this particular, you know, hijab. So I looked and it really didn't look like a hijab to me, and my understanding of what hijab is. But people were saying, "Oh, this is a modern, this is what is known as a as an inner hijab or a ninja hijab," where you put it on, and then after that, the scarf outside that you wear, it can be a bit diaphanous or transparent or whatever, but you know, that was a fashion thing that people would wear. So it was like, my God, how many layers to the hijab was there? I don't know, you know. As far as concerned, someone like my mother would, for example, she would have like a, what is known as a serkop, which is like a cap, right? Usually like crochet or something, like just wear it, put it on. Like, you see the makcik at home with that, when she's not wearing the tudung, she'll wear that, you see? So that was the only thing that I knew. So I didn't know there was like newer sort of innovations to the hijab. So, you know, so I tried telling people, oh, you know, this wasn't something where people decided, oh, let's put on this inner hijab and then let's pose in sexy clothes. And, you know, I mean, it was happy birthday to this person. It was a shot that was taken during a break rehearsals. But by that point of time, people just so incensed. And this whole hijab thing was just very sensitive, you know. So more and more people came in. And I think I had to tell the Eka Matras people, hey, I think you need to remove the photo from the Eka Matras page. You know? I think you need to. And I remember that Irfan was quite insistent that since the company had done nothing wrong, you know, we shouldn't take it down. But I just told him, if it's social media, yeah, you can come up with like a very long reason explanation. No one's gonna read it. People are just gonna look at that photo, see that one caption, and make judgments, you know. And you are just gonna look like this like yampang theater company that doesn't know what is Islamic protocol or whatever, and you know, making light, making fun, coming up with this whole concept of sexy hijab, whatever shit that people are accusing you of. Yeah. So that was a so-called controversy about it. Yeah. We found out later that the person who first started the whole mess was also someone who has had his eye on Maimuna for a while. Had his eye, not so much that he likes her, whatever, but when Muna and Hirzi were gonna do some stuff on Suria Television, he came up with a whole page which was like, we don't want to see Muna and Hirzi on Suria. Yeah, so an anti-Muna and Hirzi Facebook page. And this person used to be Muna's own Malay cikgu back when she was in secondary school. So you know, obviously, mischief bordering on malice. You know, I wonder if Muna was in that picture, would like he have been so free to go to the Eka Matras page and look at this photo that was taken long before the play even premiered. You know, it was a rehearsal photo.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, target her and try to drag her through the mud. Character assassination, really. Mm.
Okay.
So I don't know, right? Is it that he feels like he's failed as a teacher in some way? Because, you know, Muna and Hirzi, they do this quite naughty kind of videos,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But why is it his business? I don't know. Yeah. Anyway. Mm.
Okay. Was the work conceived to contrast or complement other work in the Singapore scene?
Was it to contrast or complement?
In your own, or maybe even in your own works?
Right. I think what's interesting for me was I have been writing plays. I have been doing verbatim theatre for the past couple of years. So I did Kupokari last year, and 2 years before that I did the play Cooling of Day. So those were based on interviews, right? So I would edit those interviews and then string it together into a performance piece. So actually writing KKPL was very fun. Because as I don't know whether you have to transcribe this interview yourself, but you know, yeah, every 1 minute is 2 minutes worth of transcribing, right? So it's like, oh my god, 1 hour interview, you have to spend 2 hours just transcribing. It's a pain, actually. A lot of research had to be done, and after that, still have to edit now. So I felt very free to just sit down and come up with these characters just, you know, from the top of my head. And what was interesting was, because Wild Rice Stage, one of my very early plays I did in 2000 called Dream Play, Asian Boys Volume 1. And that was also completely ridiculous, absurd. There was a central character called Agnes also, who was really mad, you know. So it was nice to have that kind of a character in the form of Maslinda Selamat in KKPL.
Okay. What were the main artistic challenges that mm-hmm. you faced with this production?
Artistic challenges, huh? What's the main challenges that I... I thought the writing was quite okay, quite smooth sailing. You know, once I let the characters live in my head for a while, then it was easy to see them, you know, just come alive on the page. I wouldn't say it was so much an artistic challenge, because from the beginning I thought, you know, the tone, I had already found the tone, it was gonna be really going to the extremities of what was ridiculous, you know, and the comedy was really in playing it quite straight. Yeah. So Najib's character, this Maslinda Selamat, had to really, really believe in what she was saying, even though what was coming out of her mouth was nonsense, right? When she said stuff you know, I really want to be a wet nurse for your baby, you know, and I've already shaved, and you know, anytime I just need to stuff it into your baby's mouth, and you know, to say it with a straight face, yeah. So she says, "I want to be a..." Remember this dialogue, right? "I want to be a wet nurse for your baby when she comes out." And the sister's like, no, you can't, because you know, to be a wet nurse, you need to lactate, you need to have breast milk." And then she can actually say, "Oh, but you know, a lot of babies they need pacifiers, you know, so yes, I don't have breast milk, but why don't you just treat it like a pacifier?" So when, you know, and I've already shaved it and it's just ready to just stuff it into your baby's mouth anytime. So she had to say all these lines with complete sincerity. So that wasn't a challenge. I mean, the challenge for me though was more personal. Yeah. And I don't know whether Farid told you this, but this play really almost did not happen. Really almost did not happen. Because my mother fell ill. my mother fell ill during that time. It was very, very sudden, you know. One day, you know, she was losing memory a little bit, and we thought, she's only 62. And we thought at that point of time, was this like early onset Alzheimer's or something, you know? And then one day she just couldn't move her legs, and we thought, oh no, could this be a stroke? Brought her to hospital, and then they found 3 large tumors in her brain. And she was diagnosed with actually stage 4 lymphoma, yeah, of the brain. So this was really very sudden, very traumatic, and then she had to be hospitalized, and you know, she had to did a brain biopsy and all that. And then she had to undergo 6 sessions of chemotherapy, lah. So it was during that period. And I was like, ayo, you know, I didn't know whether I could ride the plane. I remember Farid and Irfan coming to Singapore General Hospital, and then we went, you know, and sat down, and I said, oh, Farid, I don't know, lah, can I? I know we've done the casting already, you know, and everything is good to go, but I'm really not sure that I can write this, because I'm just at the hospital every day, and you know, you just need that mental space to write as well. But I thought what was interesting was, I look at Farid's face, and he had such a sad face, and then Irfan also, you know, and I was, I think they were ready to take over the project from me. But I felt also maybe the play could be something to take my mind off this family tragedy also, lah, you know. And actually, you know, in truth, it was quite therapeutic actually to just immerse myself in writing. So finally I decided to tell Farid in front, okay, lah, I'll try, but it might come in very slowly, this play, so bear with me. Yeah. So I wrote the play, and then very, very recently, my mother finished her course of chemo, and she's in complete remission right now. The cancer's gone. So that's, yeah. The cancer's just gone. Yeah, so my gosh, it's like, you know, the past 6 or so, 7 months. Yeah, so the greater challenge for me was that, lah. You know, how could I find the time to do this? But I'm glad I did it, because, you know, I'd be sitting next to my mom, and I have my laptop in the hospital, and, you know, be trying to write. And it's good, lah, to immerse yourself in something else, actually.
What type of collaborations were you looking forward to, and what kind of collaborations did you find with this production?
Right. I think me and Farid, we've known each other for a long time. And at that point in time, he was doing more graphic design, you know, so all the collaterals, like Ikamatra. I had already started writing plays, lah, for the company. And you know, we would really treat the Ikamatra office like really a bachelor's pet kind of thing, you know, like right, and then like sleep overnight kind of thing, really, really bachelor's pet. And then sometimes like, alamak, no money, so dig around the sofas for coins just to buy instant noodles at 7-Eleven. It was really And then Effendi, who was artistic director, will come in the morning, see him, he's like sleeping on the, in front of the computer, and then I'm inside sleeping on the sofa, and Effendi will like, what is this? This is a theatre company, you know? You guys, don't treat this like your own house. I feel like I'm taking care of latchkey kids, you know? Those were the days. Those are really the days. Like, what's this? And then, you know, it's very like lepak habis, and then very like got guitar, you know, in one corner, and then we really would seem like these 2 kids who got chased out of the house. Ikamatra was like halfway house like that, you know. Yeah. Halfway house. Then in the meantime, like write play and then do poster. But really like halfway house, lah. And then just inside the Yeah, really like bachelor's pad, I tell you. And then like, bare body, you know. Can imagine, right? Smoke inside the office, terrible, terrible. Yeah. But Malay theatre companies like that.
Recording.
What is it?
Recording.
Recording? No, I mean, that's the whole thing about being Malay theatre company, that you can do these things, that, you know, make art is like that one. Oh, thank God, 9 to 5 don't make art lah. Yeah. So, me and Farid, yeah, go back a long way. So, already me and him, I know if we have this shared vocabulary lah. So I knew we would be on the same page when directing this play. I was also looking forward to working with a lot of the actors. So I already worked with Najib a lot of times already, but mostly in English plays. I think this could be my first Malay play with him, actually. Yeah. So previously he'd acted in Cooling of Day and Kupak Kari. Yeah. So this I think was my first English play, and I really wanted to work with Mastura. You know, she'd worked on one of my plays last time. It was a monodrama, so I thought she was having a lot of fun because it's an ensemble piece. Yeah, my Muna also, you know, who's who I really love on her YouTube videos. So I thought, okay, let's see her doing theatre. Farah also, Farah Lisa, wanted to work with her. We did a little play called The Corrected Poems of Mina Jambu last time. Me and her back in the necessary stage. And Nolina, I worked with her as well, but this was her first Malay play. So there was a sense of like, for a couple of people, it was a first, you know. And I thought there was really something quite nice about that. But the feeling of it's an ensemble and people are sharing tips with each other. And it was so great that it was practically an all-woman ensemble, with the exception of Najib. And it's so funny to see, I don't know whether Muna shared with you, but, you know, backstage is really, I mean, the dynamics you see on stage is reproduced, you know, backstage, because Najib can't stand their endless... And then you can see that they're completely ostracizing Najib. So Najib's always in one corner, don't know doing well, talking to girlfriend or doing his own thing, and the rest are like nah, 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 nah. And I'm not, you know, I'm not being sexist or whatever, by you know, but they really have a lot of things to talk about. They really really do, really. Yeah, Nolina I think is the chief lah.
She didn't tell me this one.
She didn't tell you that. Talk. Even on stage, like, okay, positions. Okay, positions, so they're like that. And then still got time to, like, even in the positions, turn a bit just so can face the other person and talk. Talk across the stage, talk. You're talking. Yeah.
No, but, like, I came for one of the rehearsals, so I know that they're very chatty.
They really enjoy each other's company, yeah.
She said it was very like a family.
They really got along like a house on fire lah. Najib cannot stand after a while. It's like, oh goodness.
Okay, I think I'll go into, because this one says, do you have any preparatory training? But I don't think there's any
preparatory training. For the actors or?
Yeah, la, so I don't think it applies to for you. La.
Oh, okay,
so,
okay.
Because I think you went into a little bit about how you manage time with this a bit differently because of your situation. How did you allocate time specifically for different parts of the process? Because it was written during while the play was in rehearsal already. So maybe you could elaborate more about that process and how it was for you. And also, is it usual for you to do something like that?
Right. I mean, these days, I would very much prefer to let the company have a full script, lah. You know. It's very important, of course. I mean, for the director to have a overall idea what the play is, like the designers also, right? Because you don't want to, okay, give you scene by scene, and then suddenly like last scene, the set explodes, you know, and then you can have a design. I'm like, how? You know, and then I come up with like really something, which was not even hinted at in the earlier scene. So you don't want to spring these things on all your other theatre collaborators, but I think for this one, I really had to give the script in bits, you know, piecemeal, and it would come in even as they were rehearsing the earlier scenes. So I think because of that, I had to be okay. I'm not gonna, as I said, spring any surprises with the later scenes, you know. Yeah. So definitely, I think it did affect what the play, you know, eventually looked like, because I think if I were to give it one piece, then maybe the ending, I could have, like, not to say that I wanted a different ending, you know? But I think that the process sort of dictated that I'm not radically alter, you know, the scenes. Hang on, sorry. Hello, Ivan. Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. So yeah lah. So it was going piecemeal. That for me is not the most ideal situation lah.
Okay. And then what was it? Yeah. How does this work relate to the overall or usual work of your work,
mm-hmm.
or of your works or this company?
How does it relate to the works of the company?
Because I know it was also the anniversary.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think Ekamatra, I have been doing quite a few plays, actually, the companies ever since, I believe, 1998. Yeah. So Ekamatra is interesting because, I mean, we had so many artistic directors. And therefore, you can say that there's no particular sort of house style, you know, associated with the company. Each artistic director will bring something new lah. So Effendi was known for his very spare, minimalist, quite physical theatre works. Someone like Zizi has been trying to do works more in English, you know. So even though it's a Malay theatre company, but for her, you don't have to write in Malay to deal with certain sort of Malay issues or themes or subjects. So where do I come in? I think most of my plays have always been in the socio-political vein lah. So I did a play about about civil marriage and Islam. in the play Nadira, for example. I did another play called Para, which is about racial politics in Malaysia, and with KKPL, it's about terrorism. So I think there has been, on my part at least, you know, the body of work, I think, has consistently been, I suppose, more overtly political than, say, some of the other works by other Ekamatra members.
Okay.
Is that the last?
One more.
Sure.
Okay. Is there any idea or aspect of this production that you'd like to develop further in subsequent works, and why? Other than put Ivan in Tudong.
This particular work, how? You see, since I won the Life Theatre Awards for best script, right? That's the thing about awards, lah. That's you know, I do like to think that the play can be further improved, you know. But then, if I'm lazy, I can always just flash the award at whatever's face and say, what for? Win already, the play is perfect, what for wanna change? Yeah, but no, but kidding aside, I think I did write it during a time when I didn't have the luxury of time, yeah. So if I were to develop it deeper, etc., I think the character of the youngest sister might be a bit more conflicted. Because as the play stands right now, the chorus of the four sisters are quite single-minded in their attitude towards Maslinda binti Selamat. So the conflict was quite clear, you know, four against one. But then what if the younger sister, who's also the one who lives in the same house as Maslinda, was maybe a bit more sympathetic? And therefore, the conflict, there's a secondary conflict, lah, which is Rashida, the younger sister, being in a kind of tug of war between the three sisters and the Maslinda. I think that might be something I want to explore, lah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just the dramatic shape of it, but definitely the theme and the allegory and all that, I think can be retained.
Mm. Is there any final words that you'd like to say?
The final words. Wow. Final words. I had a lot of fun, lah. I think, yeah, doing this play, and I think I really look forward to a restaging if, you know, Ikamacho wants to, yeah, do the play again. So fun to work with so many wonderful actors also, yeah, in the play. And also I think it was interesting also for me to see the kinds of mischief some people are up to, and how it really is a battle, you know, because I think there are some people who see it fit to critique something out of context, yeah, to just, you know, condemn and judge something even without having watched the play, that's one thing, yeah. And then to read a lot of sinister motivations into art and writing, I find that kind of thing, you know, initially upsetting, but then I was, at the end of the day, that's the fight, lah, you know, that you have to, I think as an artist, always not to declare innocence, whatever, but to say, hey, that there are multiple readings into something. You don't always have to choose the reading which puts the perpetrators in the most negative light, I think. Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.